unbelievable.
Uh-huh.
You know,
yeah,
so,
synchronicity there.
Yeah, quite a bit. And he told me, and so I've got a load of questions to ask.
He had a load of answers too, I bet.
Oh yeah, well, you know, his associations get no holds barred. I mean, he's out there in the ozone. He's out in outer space, and it's great. That's what I love about him. He's a stimulating man. But, you know, it goes from Pink Floyd to let's see. Well, we have a common interest, apparently. I mean, you're probably more advanced than I am. I was trained in neuro-linguistics programming.
Oh, you were?
By Anthony Robbins.
Well, I took... well, I got into... Korzybski and...
Oh, yeah, Korzybski's great, isn't he?
Yeah, well, he's really the founder of that.
He is, yes, he is. And if you ask a PhD in linguistics graduate from any college about Korzybski, he's never heard of him.
Huh?
Yeah, they just, you know why? Because he didn't have the right letters after his name. He wasn't part of the academe.
Yeah, but he was, I think he was quite a fabulous financial man.
Oh, was he?
And this was like... a hobby to him.
Right, well...
Yeah. In other words, amongst his brilliance was this.
Well, I think his book is out of print, you know, and it has been for a long time. And
yeah, let's see, wasn't that called Science Insanity?
Yeah, Science Insanity.
Okay.
And Hubbard...
L.
Ron Hubbard gives him credit, and Bandler and Grinder. Another person we didn't talk about that you might know is... Gregory Bateson. Did you ever know him? He was Margaret Mead's husband.
Oh, not well. Just
yeah.
About him, I think.
You knew Huxley, though, right?
I didn't know Huxley.
Didn't.
I was well aware of his work. And I admired him. He was really up on the...
Right.
The thing about Huxley that was so incredible is he died at the same time as Kennedy on acid.
Same time. That's right.
Hmm?
I used that in a story I wrote.
You do?
Yeah. There was a third guy that died the same time, and I called him Dead Body. He was his name was Don Kennedy, believe it or not, but I just thought, well, that's too preposterous. I can't, and not only that, I don't know how his family or anything felt about it. But a guy threw him in the back of a dumpster, of a garbage truck, you know, dumpster. They had a fight, and he threw him into the... He might have knocked him unconscious, and then the garbage compactor crushed him, you know. And that was the same evening that Kennedy was assassinated, and Huxley died sometime during that day.
I think Huxley and Kennedy died within an hour of each other.
Oh, they did. They died in the afternoon, then. I mean...
Huxley did.
Did Laura Archer Huxley's book, what was it called, Timeless Moment, did you ever read that?
No, but you are the...
Well, it was all about his death, you know, it was about him dying on LSD and stuff. You know?
You are not the target or something.
Yeah, You Are Not the Target or something. No, that was another one, was it?
That
was the first book she wrote, I think. She's a good writer. So, Carolyn, man, you've told me about that, and I said, Bob, why don't you tell me that Carolyn, one of Carolyn's clients, was Huxley? And he says, well, I must have told you. And I said, I don't remember. I wouldn't remember that. But anyway, so he's given me a lot of stuff that may be unfounded or not, and whatever you say goes. One of the things he told me about was in Hawaii in 1949. You got involved with the Kahuna people.
Yes, and I hardly knew what I was doing.
Yeah, and they're all gone now. You know, it's all pretty corrupt. I understand.
Well, I suppose.
In Hawaii.
But you see, the thing that happened was I was in the Navy, and. My first liberty, I stopped in... I was in Kaneohe, which was over on the other side of the island. And so I came into the YMCA down downtown Honolulu. And there was a radio, I mean, there was a, some kind of a show going on in the auditorium. And I found it very enjoyable, and I thought that the performers were professional actors. It turns out it was servicemen who took a course there at the Y. They had about two or three meetings a week. And on Saturday had put on this radio show. So I said, this is great. Where do I sign up? And it was taught by a man from the University of Hawaii, whose name I forgot at the moment. But anyway, he was very creative. So I became a part of that show. And actually learned to play the Hammond organ at the time. Took about six lessons on how to set it up. And then I started doing the background music for the show.
Oh, great.
Creating it as I went.
Great.
And then I found that there was this course being taught out at the University of Hawaii that I signed up for. But very shortly, this man left and became a part of some a special services program for the I don't remember whether it was Army or Navy or anyway, it was for the services, and did programs all over the Pacific. And his replacement was. Flash through this. Let's see. Was a woman that I started going with. I mean, actually, I signed up, and she was the replacement at the University of Hawaii of this guy. And anyway, she was in Hawaii because her husband. And she had divorced. I guess he'd been in the war, and he'd gone mental and stuff. And so she eventually got the divorce. She was the secretary for Helen Gahagan. Do you know who that was?
Yes. What was her middle name?
And so consequently, she knew all the stars.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I started going with her and taking the course, you know, on writing, acting, directing, announcing, and sound effects, that stuff. But at one point, one of her associates in Hawaii, who was a manager of KHON let her know that there was going to be a disc jockey contest and that anyway that I could become a part of it. She got me in on the first show. And the way the disc jockey contest worked, that there was four people. I assumed I would have 15 minutes, that each of us would have 15 minutes, so I kind of organized a palaver and selected and stuff. But when I got to the station, about 15 minutes before going on, I discovered that we were not going 15 minutes apiece, that we were going to be alternated one after another. And I thought, how in the world is anybody going to remember you or anything about it with that sort of thing? So I decided to create a motive. And I asked ask them if I could have access to their record library, and they said, sure. So I decided to use the word magic.
Mm-hmm.
And so I played Magic is the Moonlight, which was a great number. Mm-hmm. You probably know that.
Yeah, yeah.
And Old Black Magic.
Right.
And then I came in with, I discovered something they had that had just arrived. And so then I used a musical question, which was Cole Porter's What Is This Thing Called Love?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And wound up with Doris Day's It's Magic. It had just been released and been played in Hawaii.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, when the show was over, everybody in the station was in the other room, and they are all standing in a kind of a half circle. They said, well, you've got it. I said, well, I thought this was a listener voting prop.
Mm-hmm.
Proposition. And they say, it is, but we have the hammer. If we want it, we can. And it turned out that everybody voted for me. And anyway, they started calling me Magic Boy. And a lot of people on the island knew me as Magic Boy.
Mm-hmm.
Well, needless to say, with her relationships with some famous people that would come and go to the island,
mm-hmm.
that we had a connection with a lot of prominent people who lived in Hawaii,
mm-hmm.
and I was invited to all the parties, and when I had quite a show. I was told that my aside from some various prizes, that I was going to get sustaining time, 15 minutes after the news, for a week. And then they extended it another week, and then they told me, you know, if you sell this time, it only costs $11.25 for 15 minutes. It's called sea time. If you sell this time, you can be on indefinitely. So anyway, I wound up selling 3/4 of an hour that went on from 11:15 till midnight.
Mm-hmm.
And at first, it was costing me a taxi ride. Not at first, but when I got it to where I couldn't get downtown to catch my bus over to the Pali,
mm-hmm.
which is 17 miles,
mm-hmm.
I had to take a taxi cab.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and then one of my clients was California Hawaii Motors, and I got the use of a car, so it was okay.
Great, yeah.
But otherwise, see, I had to check back in every night.
Mm-hmm.
That was in, actually, 1948. It was 1948.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, that is where I met many people who happened to be kahunas.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't make a big deal of it. I guess I was just sailing through and including whatever was happening. And it wasn't until later somebody else said, oh, my God, don't you know who these people are? You know, I said, yes, they're just fabulous.
Yeah.
But,
right. I did... these were all native Hawaiian people you were talking about, huh?
A lot of them mm-hmm. were. Mm-hmm. I mean, the kahunas were native.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Did you know about Max Freedom Long at the time?
I knew about Max Fearmong, but I'm trying to remember why.
Well, he's the apologist to the Anglo-Saxon world for the kahunas. You know, he took the kahuna thing and learned it all and put it into a series of books. Pretty interesting stuff. Great. Big difference.
Yes,
mm-hmm.
That's right.
Big difference between...
but the one that I knew, I can't remember his last name at the moment, but it was David.
Mm-hmm.
Which, of course, was divinity, and he was nearer my age.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Max Fearmong, I don't know whether I knew or not.
Yeah, he might have. I don't know when he passed on.
Later on, I read it, but yeah. I don't. But as far as whether amongst all the people I ran around with over there, there were so many different lyrical names that were names of movie stars. For instance, there's a thing I learned about movie stars that sometimes their first and last names together have such a connection that's the way you remember them. But then when you know them by the first name and somebody refers to them by the
mm-hmm.
It's like that on at least I guess on my residue memory, because I'm probably losing it in some areas, or maybe it's just conveniently I want to lose it.
Yeah, sure. Well, the reason I'm going down this line is
that name. Once you mentioned Max Fearmong, it's still ringing, and it was powerful energy there.
Well, one of the things he brought back. I mean, I happen to think he was telling it like it was, or like he got it, which is really different than hypnosis today. Today they teach you that there's three parts: the conscious mind, the critical mind, and the subconscious. And the critical mind is the one that makes the decisions to allow information to come in to the subconscious from the conscious in a kind of arbitrary, childlike fashion. You know, the critical mind. If the information looks like something that's familiar, then it accepts it and calls it good. You know. When most of the other things that look like it are primitive, you know, childlike responses, you know, that were learned in early childhood. So the interesting thing is that for long, and the kahunas taught that there were four parts. There was not only the subconscious, but there was the superconscious. Well, they called it something.
Right.
I forgot what they called it, but it's...
Well, I was aware of that. So
there's four parts.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes,
and that is...
I must pick that up.
Yeah.
See, I've always felt like I didn't take advantage of what I had.
Well, you didn't need to. You didn't need to consciously.
I know, but I went, it's like when I was in the Orient. I mean, I was in the Navy, and I was a captain's orderly, and I was able to fly along, and I would get waste paper back, Anyway, leave, you throw it a wastebasket.
Yeah.
In these various places. And I'd sometimes stay on the base or just go to a local bar and didn't look into anything. And, and that's in a couple of times in Japan and a couple of times in China. And this was back in 1948.
Uh-huh.
Before everything changed.
Yeah, right. Uh-huh.
I was on the mainland of Tsingtao and Shanghai.
Wow. Great.
And I went to the Philippines and Australia. But to me, as an 18, 19-year-old guy, whatever was in front of me was like the relationship of my life at the time.
Yeah, you were in the Navy, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. L. Ron Hubbard was in the Navy, too, in the same theater that you were in. You probably didn't meet him there. You apparently was wounded.
The only time I saw him was there was at the center of the Corset.
Was there? He was there naked.
Yeah.
He was probably naked when he was in the hospital, too. But that's a priceless story. At some point during these interviews, I might ask you to repeat that again so I get it exactly right.
All right.
What I wanted to segue into was the subconscious, the superconscious, and the discussion of what generically is called hypnosis. There's a whole lot of things that lump together, including neurolinguistics programming, is super hypnosis, man.
As a side issue, there was a point at the Center of Integration that we had someone who came. I'm sure he was from the CIA, or else he was from A.L. Hubbard's operation in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And they were referring to the Russians using a technique to hypnotize someone in 6 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
That was by just putting a strobe on them, and just as soon as they felt they had adapted to the strobe, to hit a gong. And they had them.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were looking into the process of making someone invulnerable to that by having lots of lights and lots of different types of noises that would, you know. And of course, it wound up to be rock and roll and psychedelics.
Yeah, right.
In other words, the psychedelics and the rock and roll was our protection against that.
That's great. Yeah,
I know, it's very simple and it's very interesting. Well, where did this all come from? Because of this. Yeah,
that's great. Bob mentioned that you know the story about Pavlov telling the Soviets some kind.
Yes.
Tell me that story, will you?
I think this is one of the last things that he did.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know exactly when the timing was, but it was apparently a consternation on his part and others that he felt that they needed to know that if you conditioned somebody and did not supply that for which they were conditioned, they could not be reconditioned. That the conditioning process would, like, blow a fuse.
Hmm.
And they didn't believe him. But he did make... this is why we felt it was interesting. Because the statement he made was, if you don't understand this, that you may create the most cosmically aware people in the world.
Yeah.
And they are pretty hard to fool.
Yeah, for sure.
I mean, except on very gross levels.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
I think that's what that same thing happens over the world. I think that's why we have terrorism.
Yeah.
It's because negotiation, when it reaches a certain point, there are certain leaders or I guess you could call them leaders that acknowledge that there is going to be no more negotiation. I think around the time that Kissinger was negotiating, I think it had to do with the Vietnam War, the tail end. He made a statement to the effect that if you have people who figure they can't negotiate to get what they want, that terrorism will occur. Which is fairly obvious, but for it to be announced by a chief negotiator to say, we might be running into terrorism pretty soon.
Yeah, uh-huh.
On a big scale,
yeah.
As it is, there'd already been some.
Yeah.
Now, let's see, getting back to the superconscious thing.
Yeah.
Yes, I did understand that, and mm-hmm. I did understand it probably at the Center of Integration 2 particularly,
mm-hmm.
which was in 57, that's many years after Hawaii, but
mm-hmm.
There was a note. Let's see.
Bob said something that may relate to.
Yeah.
He's talking about something about anthropologist, and it's just apparently it's a story of yours about some primitive tribe that talked about they could resolve various things, but they could not resolve hate.
That is the Aborigines of Australia.
Uh-huh. So tell me that.
Yeah. That was Monty West. Now, I can't find him. I don't know where he is.
Uh-huh.
When I moved up here 10 years ago, I tried to locate him and couldn't find him. And even the University of Washington pretended they'd never heard of him.
Who was Monty West now?
Well, he was a professor of anthropology.
Uh-huh.
He's the one who wanted to give LSD to the city councilman here.
Great man. Thinking along the right lines.
Yeah. And anyway,
mm-hmm.
But
it was the Australia.
He went to Australia,
uh-huh.
as an anthropologist to
mm-hmm.
study them.
Mm-hmm.
And went out and lived with them in the wastelands for a year.
The outback, they call it.
Yeah, I couldn't think there for a moment.
Yeah.
Yeah. For a year,
yeah.
And he had all these photos and recordings and et cetera, and mm-hmm. after he'd been with them for a year,
mm-hmm.
he started packing things up, and he says, well, I've got to go now. And they said, oh, my God, what are you up to? You're leaving? He says, well, I've got all this information, and they just went, stared at him,
mm-hmm.
and stared at each other, and then they went off to the side and talked for a while,
mm-hmm.
and at a certain point they started to laugh, and then they got serious again, and they came back and said, well, we've got to tell you something. This culture is so protective. I mean, I don't know the complex ways in which they said it, but anyway, this culture is so protective that with everybody, we lie. Everything you have is a lie. He says, you mean all this stuff for a year is a lie? I said, yes.
Mm.
And they said, but we don't want you to leave. He says, I know, but I can't work this way.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, well, with you, we will tell you the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And so then he got 50,000 feet of film, which is a lot of footage.
Yeah.
But there's a story about that later. But anyway, one of the things they did, they went down to the south of Australia.
Mm-hmm.
I don't exactly remember where, but I've seen things on television about it, so I kind of get the idea. But there was a meeting, I guess it was once a year, but it was a regular occurrence. And there were, I think there were 18 different groups, but I can't remember for sure if that's accurate. But they would negotiate for their location for this meeting,
mm-hmm.
In other words, they would be there for a month. And the tribes, or whatever they call them, would be in certain locations. But they would negotiate their location. They always used the same spot every time, but they always had to negotiate for their spot every time, which is very interesting.
Yeah.
They didn't take it for granted.
Right.
They didn't call it a right, even though it was a right, and then it was a big deal.
Uh-huh.
And then that was in preparation for their war.
Uh-huh.
And that the war entailed one man from one tribe and one man from another tribe.
Uh-huh.
And they each had a javelin.
Uh-huh.
And they were each super marksmen.
Uh-huh.
And they would throw it, and if the javelin went through the skin, there was celebration.
Uh-huh.
Because the man would heal within 4 hours.
Oh, wow.
But if the javelin hit a joint,
uh-oh,
there was great sorrow because it meant that guy was going to die during the year.
Oh, boy.
Or,
yeah.
And anyway, Monty said, he asked this guy, is there anything you haven't solved? And he says, yes. Hate. And he says, every time one of these events occurs in which there is a reconciliation, a solving, he says the energy and change in everything is momentous. Anyway, Monty told me, he says, if they ever were this out between them, there'll probably be a universal peace in the world.
Yeah.
And he meant it.
Yeah. How do you spell Monty?
I just spelled it M-O-N-T-E.
But, oh, okay.
I don't remember for sure.
Yeah. Not to be confused with Monty Python.
Yes. Well, I'm not positive. Anyway, he's also the one who told me when I was at the Center of Integration. I mean, no, this is at Clearview many years later.
Mm-hmm.
When I was beginning to have some physical manifestations.
Mm-hmm.
This is before the ankylosing spondylitis manifested completely. But anyway, we were in the hall of the house, and we happened to meet and stop for a moment to chat. And he looked at me just like a moment out of time, and she says, David, you do know that we have to have a body to work in this time and dimension.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked at him and I says, yes, he says, well, take care of yours.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Yeah.
So were you love of the mind? Bob brought that up. He keeps calling you Dave. So he says, Dave doesn't live in his cortex. So in other words, you weren't a mental person, huh?
Well, I was. I mean, I
if you're living outside your body, you're pretty mental, I guess, huh?
Well, the thing that had to do with giving attention, in other words, sort of abusing myself by overdoing. The disassociation aspects of going into trance.
Yeah, and Bob brought up the fact that you were adamant with him at some point in some discussion about talking about being a medium without going into trance, and you encouraged that.
Uh-huh.
Is that correct?
Yes, you see, to me, I think we started to hit this on this yesterday where I got into talking about the development classes.
Yes.
It's like Vern Christensen, who was my associate, and I both agreed very thoroughly.
Mm-hmm.
Even though I went into trance and he was the one who was outside the trance,
mm-hmm.
he was also like in the trance while I was in the trance
mm-hmm.
with me.
Mm-hmm.
He was my protection in the sense of he could balance the forces around the environment while I was in there.
Mm-hmm.
And if they were not copacetic, he could call me out.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a sentinel.
Mm-hmm.
But as aware.
Mm-hmm.
And he could give the same information.
Mm-hmm.
But there again, I think it was more like because I could go in, he could follow.
Yeah.
And on his own.
Mm-hmm.
He was very aware. And so we decided that even the trance work from after the classes and those that were able, just a handful that were able to go into the deep trance,
mm-hmm.
That the state of consciousness that was conscious, or the state of consciousness that was in trance,
mm-hmm.
was essentially the same.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't exactly the same, because here's the description and a thumbnail sketch of what happened when I went into this
mm-hmm.
trance.
Mm-hmm.
I would go into it, and people would sort of read or chant the law of love.
Mm-hmm.
There are some laws and precepts from cosmic awareness that had come through it.
Mm-hmm.
And this was the law of love is that law which places the welfare and the concern and the feeling for others above self.
Mm-hmm.
The law of love is that close affinity with all forces that we associate with as good. The law of love is that force which denies the existence of evil in the world. That resists not evil. Now the keys here have to do in that, those last two lines.
Mm-hmm.
In the world.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, if there is evil
mm-hmm.
that's in the world, it's because you have placed it there.
Uh-huh.
And if you have placed it there, you have to withdraw it and deny its existence. And if you can't understand that, at least don't resist it, because it gives it energy.
Mm-hmm.
All right, anyway, this is the thing that was said. And during this time, while this is being said, I had, you know, I either had a rose or a key or something in my hand.
Mm-hmm.
I was wearing a loose white robe that was cotton or linen. It had no wool or metal, no animal. Our metal
mm-hmm.
Were used in this, I guess you'd call it a ritual.
Yeah,
I didn't think of it as a ritual.
Ceremony.
Anyway, and at my feet were seven candles that were the seven colors of, you know, from red through violet.
Mm-hmm.
And at my head was one white candle.
Uh-huh.
And I would have this object, or it was a rose or a key or something in my hand,
mm-hmm.
that would be placed kind of at the side loosely. And then I would drop it. When I felt that I had moved in, I would let go.
Mm-hmm.
And what I would let go, it was my action that let go.
Mm-hmm.
But after that, there was a shift.
Mm-hmm.
There were times when that was done that the rose would just jump out of my hand. Because I was letting go, and before I even let it go with my hand, it just jumped right out.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the thing that occurred at this point is that I didn't speak because, in other words, I didn't voluntarily speak,
mm-hmm.
Because I didn't care to.
Mm-hmm.
I was surrounded by a spinning light. In other words, if you can imagine a mummy's wrapping, except it was very fine, thin spins.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, they went completely around, but they were just fine lines of light,
mm-hmm.
that spun around.
Mm-hmm.
And I always felt that they were like a sleeve.
Mm-hmm.
Not just around me, but it's like they would go around, but then there would be like a sleeve action where they would be going the other opposite direction within that, and
mm-hmm.
I was in the middle. When someone would ask a question, it would disturb the fabric of this.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, it was perfection personified.
Mm-hmm.
But a question was a disturbance,
mm-hmm.
in that.
Mm-hmm.
And in looking at what was like, it looked like a fan,
mm-hmm.
that had words all over and symbols and in the spinning. But if I would focus right in the center and give one word at a time as it came, as I would see it in the exact center. It's like if I went out to the left or to the right or above or below, it would throw things off in terms of my vibration.
Mm-hmm.
And in order for me to keep this high vibration, to keep that one word in the center coming through. And
mm-hmm.
of course, it's like it'd be total energy for each word, and then all that would be gone, and then would all be a whole new manifestation, so that there was not really a memory.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole process of those words was to seal up and clear up the disturbance,
mm-hmm.
in this envelope of light around me.
Mm-hmm.
That in a way, someone would disturb it,
mm-hmm.
and this was my method of clearing up the disturbance.
Mm-hmm.
And in the same time, would be a method of clearing up the disturbance of the questioner.
Mm-hmm.
That the questioner's disturbance would hit me,
mm-hmm.
and the process of clearing it up would give him his answer.
Right.
And in some cases, it was the energy, I think, as much as it was the words.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, how did you start doing this medium, whatever, what do you call it? Did you call it channeling or
interpreting.
Not? And what?
An interpreter for cosmic awareness.
An interpreter. How did you start that? How did it start with you?
Well, I took the development classes,
uh-huh.
and in one of the classes, I think it's probably somewhere around between the 8th and the 11th class, there was some kind of an event where we were circling the room,
mm-hmm.
where I felt floating.
Mm-hmm.
That, I think, was probably the first. And then after that, I think there was some point where we were to lay on the floor and there was some music playing and something. And those are the two things within the class that I recall.
Mm-hmm.
But my instructor was Geraldine Morris, and she said that she witnessed it and she knew that I was going to do this later. But mm-hmm. when it actually occurred, I was in a gay bath in downtown Seattle called Dave's,
mm-hmm.
that I knew the owners from San Francisco years before.
Mm.
And I happened to be in there just in a room, practically sleeping, and all of a sudden I saw this ball of blue, and of course the blue ball is a symbol of mercy. It's blue pearl, usually it's considered,
mm-hmm.
but anyway, this was like gelatin, and it was filled with people, and every time anybody made a move, it made everybody else move.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And this was the phenomena that I was tuning into, mm-hmm. and then all of a sudden I could feel that I was going into trance. And I just had time to say, well, make it the highest and the best, and don't make it long. And off I went, and that was my first experience.
Wow.
And I related this to a woman named Claire Olson, who was in the OSS, by the way.
Oh, yeah.
And probably was the one who triggered off all the CIA action later.
Yeah, maybe.
Because this, you know, this, I mean, I knew her back
mm-hmm.
Before I ever went to the Center of Integration.
Mm-hmm.
She's the one who got me to go to the Center of Integration.
Mm-hmm.
And that was in 1956.
Yeah.
And this time I'm talking about going into trance was, about 1963 or 64.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I went over to her house and told her about it, and she got out some cards and started shuffling around. She started getting excited.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, she had me go into trance for her.
Uh-huh.
And when I started to do it deliberately, I thought, oh God, what a fiasco this is going to be. And even though I had a thing in my hand, I was grasping it very tightly because I wasn't going to have it accidentally drop and have her think that I was in trance.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that was one of those times where it really did practically jump out of my hand.
Uh-huh.
And anyway, then when I was in it,
mm-hmm.
She tuned in enough, but in within, I was like, oh my God, it's all true.
Right. Now, you know, go ahead.
So I very carefully responded to her by going into these levels, and we reported it to Dr. Newby, who
mm-hmm.
was the one who had been going into trance
mm-hmm.
all the time, and I wanted to give do me the tapes that I made for her. And she just had a temper tantrum.
Huh.
And I know what it was. It was not wanting people to know. It wasn't going to be her that those inner things were not going to be revealed for anybody to play with.
Uh-huh.
And as a matter of fact, I think I had the tapes and gave them to Doobie, but Doobie just gave them back to her. But there was we had a little bit of a, and I learned something very much at that time.
Uh-huh.
And so over the next about a year, I think I probably went into trance around 40 times. But I found I could go into trance quite a bit, and then when there was one alchemical circle thing, which was one of those powerful things that it was really kind of verboten, where he was in trance, and then he called out some woman's name and gave her accolades and all the rest of it, and it just changed, the vibes just changed.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, he was working her for money. She was a very rich woman. You know?
Oh, God.
And see, he was a Capricorn.
Yep.
And he had said at the beginning that, and people didn't really know whether he was for real.
Yeah.
He says, yes, I know, because that's my problem, is the pursuit of power. And he said, then why... Why are you doing it? He says, because I don't know what else to do. He says, it saved my life.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what else to do. But anyway, when I recognized that he made a shift and grabbed hold, I resigned within a month.
Huh.
I confronted him, and we talked about it. And he sort of agreed with me, and I said, well, this has to be talked to the board, because that means that if you're going to be putting decisions, your decisions, in the midst of this, we got to know that.
Mm-hmm.
And I says, if you're doing that and knowingly, then okay, but if you're going to manipulate that level on that many people, this is something I don't want to have anything a part of.
Sounds like Shockley.
Well, you're right.
We were there. Bob reminded me we were there in March of 82, which I wrote down for you because I wasn't. I thought it was 81, but
you what?
I thought it was when we were talking yesterday. I thought it was 1981 that we
I was in California.
It was in 82 that we were there. I think he'd seen you. I thought he saw you shortly before that. But never.
No, he didn't see me from the time they pulled that trip.
Yeah.
Until 1986 when I came up.
Mm-hmm.
And then we did seem to have a reconciliation of yes and no.
Mm-hmm.
Except it didn't really work. I mean, he said something, but he didn't follow through.
There was some of the...
In other words, he said he was going to stop trancing.
Yeah, that's what he told us, too. There was another guy that was hanging around him, and I can't remember.
You sure that it was in 82?
That's what Bob said it was 82.
Yeah, well, how about you? What do you think was
82? I know, I thought, you know, 82 could be right, but...
But 86 was when I saw him.
Yeah. Okay.
I've been in California, and I came up here, and I saw him, and we had this thing, and he said he was going to stop trancing.
Right, well...
That's why I wondered.
Yeah. Well, no, I think it was before. If Bob says it was 82, he's got one of those kind of minds that remembers dates, and... Yeah, I don't remember any dates. You know, it's all one continuous present for me.
Yes, I remember events, and sometimes I can remember who my lover was or what house I lived in.
Yeah, or where you parked your car. You know, those important things. Bob mentioned, and then I want to get back to the trance thing. But he mentioned which kind of fits in with what you were saying there, that you said something that about, or maybe you quoted somebody or something, but the concept was power, sex, and money must be aligned properly. Do you remember anything like
well,
that?
Well, I know that money, power, and sex were significant, but if they became more significant than the other, then I wouldn't have any part of it.
Mm-hmm.
I remember making a reference to that at Stanford,
mm-hmm.
and particularly to Danton Spivey.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Danton Spivey was a guy who eventually tranced and was pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
But in his early stages, I remember one time he was on acid and he was going to be offering me all kinds of money, sex, and power. And I said, look, I've had them already. And there's nothing that you can offer me that I need in that whole area. And he had his hand, he took his fingers and he jabbed me in my chest just below the shoulder. And it was like a karate jab. And I'm telling you, it took me weeks to get over that. And he looked at me after he did it and put his hand on his hip and he says, but it's so boring.
Yeah.
And so then I related to him after that about thought. That if you stay within thought with these energies, it just will absolutely tear you apart or go through you and tear somebody else apart. That the thing one does is process what comes at you. And if you pass it on, then you've got that karma to deal with eventually. So the thing is, why have the karma? Why have bad karma? That to process. And so there's many things that I'm annoyed at processing. But I process them anyway. And then it doesn't get thrown out into the world. I don't know where I got sidetracked here.
Well, I took you there.
I am not in space. What am I doing?
That's a digression.
Okay, it's kind of strange, this thing of answering questions.
Yeah, it is. Especially since they're really of Bob's origin, so I'm trying to interpret them.
Well, it's all right.
So that it makes sense to me and you.
Yeah. Incidentally, I've felt several different times a familiarity with your voice.
Yeah.
I know that we hadn't talked before.
No.
And I finally came up with Lou Audette, who's a minister of awareness. Whose voice and communication and vibration is similar enough that while we're talking, I almost call you Lou a couple of times, which is very unusual.
Well, I don't know Lou, but I've been told I have many doppelgangers. Yeah.
Well, I'll get into stuff about Lou at a later point.
Okay.
There's three brothers, the Audettes. They were born in Salem, Massachusetts.
How do you spell the last name?
A-U-D-E-T.
Okay.
And one was a patent attorney, and another one was one of the big Washington lawyers. His property is next to the CIA in McLean, Virginia.
Mm. Hm.
He bought 11 acres.
Oh, did he? I probably know where it is. I've been there.
And Lou mm-hmm. was a... I don't know how high he was in IBM, but
mm-hmm.
I know that he had pretty big salary and mm-hmm. pretty big position. And when they bought him out into early retirement, he mm-hmm. had a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a wonderful wife, Beverly, mm-hmm. but she passed.
Mm-hmm.
But she was so extraordinary.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of awareness, but she was a fantastic masseuse, but it wasn't just a masseuse. It
mm-hmm.
seemed like she could have, she could look at somebody and see. And she was a
yeah.
just a bright woman who mm-hmm. who shone all the time.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry to see she went, but. But anyway, Lou.
Maybe only the good die young, you know.
Anyway, Lou's voice and yours are comparable, and I feel blessed. You should.
Well, I'm yeah. If you say so, okay, good. I'm thinking about the thinking again about hypnosis, going back to that generalized term hypnosis, you know, which is that's the core of this.
Now,
yeah, right.
I think when, there was something I thought about when we talked about it before.
Mm-hmm.
When I was back at, let's see, this would have been about 71.
Mm-hmm.
1970 or 1971, where I went on a tour of colleges.
Mm-hmm.
I helped set up courses in, or instigated, shall we say,
mm-hmm.
Courses in parapsychology in about, 10 colleges and universities, and of course, countless churches and so on, in about a 6 month period.
Mm-hmm.
It was something new for me to be away from headquarters that long, and I was flashing through the places I went to, and of course I was at Menninger Foundation in Topeka, which I was born in Topeka.
Uh-huh.
My aunt worked for my mother. Was the housekeeper for the Menningers.
Oh, really?
My aunt became a statistician and then later involved in higher levels. As she got more education at Menningers. And
mm-hmm.
then I went there to lecture to 7 psychiatrists about LSD and the experiences we had.
Mm-hmm.
As a result, they formed the Altered States of Consciousness Group.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I saw them again, I told them, I said, you should change your name because there are so many different states of consciousness. And I said, you should get known seers in.
Mm-hmm.
And set up some kind of a biofeedback. And so the first biofeedback, I'm responsible for that. They brought Elmer Green in from Australia for that.
Mm.
And
now, did you ever formally study hypnosis?
I'm trying to remember.
Yeah.
I knew this guy who came to the center,
mm-hmm.
who was the one whose name I can't remember,
mm-hmm.
but I think his name was Lou, too, but I forgot.
Mm-hmm.
that he came about the time Kitzelman did.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, we had visiting lectures and
mm-hmm.
swamis and people from all over.
This is not Dave Millett, is it?
No, Dave Millett I met at the center.
Oh, okay.
When he was 16 years old.
And oh.
The thing I noted about him was he was kinetic.
Ah.
I saw a bowl jump from one end of a dining
mm-hmm.
table that had the, you know, had the, it was like the offering plate.
Yeah.
It was a bowl, and it jumped from one end to the other of the table.
Without breaking?
Yeah.
That's a feat.
And it was the only person near it was him, and mm-hmm. I was watching. And it's either I did it or he did.
Mm-hmm.
But I saw things happening over.
Yeah.
So I knew that adolescents often had that kind of energy. But he
mm-hmm.
he's never married, and he's a perennial adolescent.
Yeah. Yeah. That seems to be where the poltergeist thing comes from too.
Yeah, I think so.
Teenage kids and stuff. Ingo Swann, you know, has got that ability.
Who?
Ingo Swann.
That's a familiar name.
He was one of the five guys. I think he was Ingo Swann, the fireman, Pat Price, Uri Geller.
Yes.
Somebody else at SRI when they were doing the remote viewing experiments.
Oh, yes.
And they were also having Uri try to stop something inside a glass, you know. And then he decided he would go into the computer room and he just ran amok mentally with the computers. You know, you know those stories.
Well,
you've done it too.
Well, I don't try. I mean, I had people who worked for me who had the computers, but I stayed off of them.
Yeah.
Well, that's a whole thing I don't want to get into.
That's the whole thing we won't get into. But I want to kick you a little bit there, just to follow up on the. Today's questions. Today's assignment.
Now,
from
we zipped around through the universe there for a while.
Yeah.
Let's see now.
Okay.
What was the last?
Well, I was trying to. I was
talking about Lou.
Yeah, I was trying to center in on. You used the word trance, right? And the thing you're talking about is some.
Oh yeah.
Is a very deep kind of trance.
Okay, but we were also talking about the superconscious.
Yeah, and then the reason all of this, that, and I ask you if you had formal hypnosis training, you know.
Oh,
did you?
There it is.
Yeah.
Back at the center.
Yeah.
And this was before acid.
Yeah.
This guy came
mm-hmm.
who talked about hypnosis.
Mm-hmm.
And he very quickly did it, very simply,
mm-hmm.
with a number of people.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw that there was something to it.
Mm-hmm.
And later, it turns out he was the source for acid in the chain of command from A.L. Hubbard.
Okay, so he was probably a CIA guy.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And
his background is even more curious because
yeah.
he was an incorrigible criminal in solitary confinement for 6 months and had an enlightenment and then asked for help from the local psychiatrist and chaplain
uh-huh.
in prison. And they were so impressed that they brought in Star Daly, who had written a book. Excuse me for a moment.
That's all right.
Love can open prison doors.
Huh. Hmm.
Anyway, it was a very profound experience for him.
Yeah.
And, they had him work with the chaplain's office.
Uh-huh.
And here, he walked out of prison. Mm-hmm. And probably right into the arms of the CIA.
Yeah, maybe that was...
I think that's what happened.
Yeah.
And isn't it amazing? I still can't quite get his name.
Okay, well, maybe...
But he was the source of acid from... Mm-hmm. From A.L. Hubbard. There was... I figured out one time there was 9 people. There was Hubbard.
Uh-huh.
He had 5 psychiatrists working for him, I think. Or maybe he was... Yeah, he was a clinical psychologist, and they were psychiatrists.
Uh-huh. So he was working for them.
He owned the place, but they worked for him.
Yeah.
And... but then there were others that I met over the years that were in the next level and then the next level, and then he was down there, and he had the, and he's the one who gave it to David Street or Elliot Craig, whichever name you want to use,
mm-hmm.
that gave it to me.
Uh-huh.
That Elliot Craig and he had been business partners in something.
Mm-hmm.
I think they like stereo, they were into stereo, and see, stereo hadn't been released. They just knew the components, and they would have people put them together.
Mm-hmm.
So we had some of the first stereo equipment in the country for our sessions.
Mm-hmm.
About 50 albums that had been made as experiments in different recording companies.
Mm.
And only about 10 of those made it to the market, but they were the top 10 of the first releases.
Well, now, what were the releases? I mean, was this people recording music or something with your...
Oh, there was music.
Uh-huh.
There was... They were trip records.
Oh, okay. All right.
Basically, many of them.
And who published them, do you know?
Well, they were all these different... I don't know who...
Different.
They were all, they're all these different recording companies had done it, apparently.
Was ESP
somebody
one?
Had a master plan, so to speak.
Yeah, was ESP Records part of them? Was it a
model? I don't think they existed yet.
That was 65.
But anyway, back to this guy.
Yeah.
Whose name I almost catch.
Mm-hmm.
He did talk on hypnosis and demonstrated, and then later the acid came about, and awareness. See, I was into Krishnamurti almost completely.
Right.
A
credit to you, sir.
Huh?
A credit to you.
Well, when I first came to the center...
Yeah.
See, I haven't told you about the haunted house yet, have I?
No, you haven't.
You haven't heard about it, huh?
No.
That's where it all started for me.
Oh, really?
At 518 West Roy, I had leased a mansion that was going to be torn down. I was the one who designed the specifications and assigned the drawings to 144 draftsmen in John Graham Incorporated. And the first job I had there was on the third phase of Northgate, which was the first shopping center. And then 28 more of the world's largest shopping centers were my province. And I signed, I checked them and signed them, and then the architect signed them. Now, mind you, I had no degree or anything in this. It's just acumen, man. And that was in 56. And, of course, it was a pretty powerful job that I had gotten into.
Yeah.
And because of my connections, there was an architect by the name of Victor N. Jones who had this mansion, and I found that I could lease it from him in the meantime. So I went in with Chris Byrne, Vern Christensen, but he went by Chris Christensen a lot, too. So if you hear me say Chris or Vern, it's interchangeable. It's the same person.
Mm-hmm.
Most people in our work knew him as Vern.
Mm-hmm.
Only a few knew him as Chris, and then later he went as Chris because he'd been a singer with big bands, and he was Chris Christensen with the big bands. But no, I slipped a cog. help me.
Okay.
The haunted house bit.
The haunted house, right.
So we started remodeling parts of the mansion so that we could turn it into several apartments.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd live there, and there were some more apartments that were being fixed up.
Mm-hmm.
Well, one night, while sleeping, I had this feeling of a presence. Only I actually, it was a visual thing where I saw a woman sitting in the breakfast nook, which was actually behind me and three or four rooms over. So I couldn't. It had to be distant viewing, right on the spot.
Mm-hmm.
To start with. And I saw her sitting in this booth, and she had a folder or a booklet that she looked at, and she sighed and she closed it and got up and moved into the kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it was so real that I got up to go in and turn on lights to see if there was somebody there.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember she had a dress on that was blue, dark, like navy blue, but with little tiny white flowers all over it that kind of looked like a stylized daisy.
Mm-hmm.
As a pattern on the dress. But anyway, hold on. I got somebody buzzing my door.
Yeah, go ahead.
Hold on.
Uh-huh. What are you going to do?
Yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You want to make me a cup of coffee? I'll get him to make me a cup of coffee, too.
Great.
Anyway, I went back to bed.
Mm-hmm.
And I went back into the hypnagogic state, and just as I was starting to fall asleep,
mm-hmm,
I woke up, and here over my bed were seven candles, all lit. And I was looking at it. Here's an apparition over my bed of these lights.
Mm-hmm.
And I just took my hand and swept across it. I didn't know what else to do.
Mm-hmm.
And they disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
And I got up. And we had some dogs that were down in the basement. And they started making so much noise, I had to bring them up because we had an apartment building up behind. And it was the middle of the night. I didn't want that to disturb them.
Mm-hmm.
And when they came up, they kept looking and barking and making noise and looking up in the middle of the room.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of going in circles, two of them going in circles, and both looking up at this thing. And so I went over and sat down on the couch to get them to come and sit in my lap and quiet them down. And then one of them jumped down and started scooting around the room. And then all of a sudden he ran after it and ran right up the couch and over across my back and down.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, talk about freaking out.
Yeah.
And so this phenomena was, you know, I was scientifically minded, had no interest in psychic things whatsoever, felt it was a bunch of bull and everything else.
Mm-hmm.
But I had been at a party someplace where this woman was talking about psychic phenomena. phenomenon, and I thought she was an interesting kook and everything else. But anyway, I got up and went to work, but I was disturbed. And I called her during lunch period and told her a little bit. She says, well, you should go to the psychic library downtown. Told me where it was, and it was only about 2 blocks from where I worked. So on my lunch period, I told my boss that I'll probably take a little extra time for lunch. He says, that's fine, it's fine, you know. So I went to the psychic library, and they kept wanting to shove books at me, You Live After Death, and I said, that isn't the kind of thing I'm looking into. And she says, well, you could talk to the medium when she comes out. She's with someone now. Anyway, when the woman came out, she just got out of the door and into the waiting room or the library room, and she looked at me and she says, I'm upset. And I looked at her and I says, you're upset. I'm upset. And she says, well, I don't mean I'm upset. I mean my guides are upset. I said, your guides? I never heard of guides. What's guides? And so she told me a little bit. And then she proceeded to tell me pretty much what had happened. That I was in a large house in which these things had occurred. And I said, well, what in the world do we do about it? She says, well, I suppose we could have an exorcism. I said, for God's sake, yes, whatever that is, if it works. And I says, come on, let's go right now. She says, oh, no, I have to take 2 or 3 days. I'm preparing for it. And I said, well, what do I do in the meantime? And she says, well, do you know the Lord's Prayer? I said, yes. She says, well, you can use that. And she says, and don't be fearful, because if you become fearful, it opens your aura and they can get in. And I said, but I am afraid. How can I not be? I said, how can I cancel that? She says, well, what you can do is say the Lord's Prayer. And she says, what you can do is put the keys to the house on a Bible and say, Lord, we give this house back to you. Well, really, the implications of that phrase are voluminous, I'm telling you, because anyway, I told the guys, Vern and Cecil, what I'd found out, and Vern got very upset. He wanted to get out of there right away. He says, let's leave this place. I said, but we've got a lot of investment here. But he was, and he says, what are we going to do? And I said, he sat down on one end of the couch, and I was on the other, and I said, well, she said that we could say the Lord's Prayer. And he said something about, that's like telling somebody you're going to die, but I'll pray for you. And he sat down in a slump and gasped and groaned at the end of the couch and leaned forward. And this was not quite sundown yet. And I looked up, and there was this wraith type of thing that was about 4 or 5 feet away from him and about 6 or 8 feet from me. Cecil was over in the corner in a swing rocker with his knees up to his chest. And I said something. In some way, I signaled to Chris that this thing was there, and Chris looked up, and he screamed, and as he screamed, the thing moved toward him. I reached across to grab him, to pull him away and across the couch into my lap, and where I touched him, he had a burn on his arm, and I got hit on the left side of my brain, and my left side almost went into paralysis, mm-hmm. and I couldn't think. And I had been saying, I had probably said about three or four lines of the Lord's Prayer.
Mm-hmm.
Cease had been a minister, so I looked over at Cease, I said, feed me the lines.
Yeah.
And he started giving me the rest of the lines, and by the time I'd finished the Lord's Prayer, we were kind of poised, but we were all going to leave. Mm-hmm. And I said, but before I do, we got to put the keys to the house on the Bible, on the mantle, and say, Lord, this give this house back to you. So I went over, and I put my hand on it, and I started to say this, Lord, we give this house back to you, mm-hmm. and this incredible energy started to pour through me
mm-hmm.
that I could hardly handle, I could hardly stand, but I wouldn't stop until I finished it.
Mm-hmm.
And so then we went out the back door and up to the next street.
Mm-hmm.
There was a mansion above that we had lived in. We knew the gal who lived there. She had been our landlady, and so we were going to use the phone there. I was going to call Rita, this gal at the cocktail party who had the information.
Mm-hmm.
And the phone wouldn't work.
Mm.
Could not get it to work.
Mm-hmm.
And it was upsetting her, the woman there so much that we decided to leave.
Mm-hmm.
And so the three of us left, and it was, as I said, it was about sundown that the lights, the street lights were just starting to come on. And this is Queen Anne Hill in Seattle, so mm-hmm. it's like it was a about a 6-block walk down to the Queen Anne Village. We started to walk along, the three of us,
mm-hmm.
and all of a sudden I could see we had these huge auras that were like lavender blue,
mm-hmm.
Transparent, and all three of us had it, and we were walking, and it was an incredible walk.
Yeah.
Walking together down, yeah. And then when I got to a telephone booth, we were able to get a cab right away and go over to Rita's, and she says, that's all right. She says, this house is protected.
Hmm.
But, of course, the energy that I had coming through me was so much that eventually it freaked them out.
Mm-hmm.
She tried to call a number of psychics, and she finally got a hold of one by the name of Pauline Vinton. And when she put me on the phone, she screamed, and she said, oh, my God, I'll have to call you back. And I found out that apparently the energy that was operating had hit her in the solar plexus.
Wow.
So she had to go through a trip. Anyway, she told me to read the 139th Psalm. And I think we talked about that.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And
I haven't been able to find it yet.
someone handed me the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
They opened it up. And there was 136, but it turned out to be the 136th book of the 118th Psalm, which has more than 136
mm-hmm.
verses. And anyway, about that time, I started having what I say is 10,000 volts.
Yeah.
Going through me
mm-hmm.
every 10 seconds.
Wow.
And it lasted 36 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, I think, where I told you about the golden brain and the mm-hmm. carbon.
Mm-hmm.
And then ultimately, someone came and got us and took us to another place, and there we found the real Bible.
Yeah.
Or the Bible with the real passage.
Well, the one you were looking for, yeah.
And then as I read it, yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, it was because of that
mm-hmm.
Well, I went into work,
mm-hmm.
of course, and my capacity was so incredible that 144 draftsmen couldn't keep me busy.
Wow.
And I got out in the middle of the drafting room floor and practically screamed, if you guys don't produce more, I don't know what I'm going to do. I don't have enough to do. And the owner come out and he says, what's going on? What's going on? I said, well, something's freaking him out. He's just got so much energy. And of course, at first they were fascinated, and finally it was more than anybody could handle it. It was
mm-hmm.
completely disruptive of the office.
Mm-hmm.
And so anyway, I wound up getting, I think it was technically I was supposed to get 6 months pay leave and come back, but
mm-hmm.
I never went back. But at least I was covered. And then I started looking, and I went everywhere. I mean, I traveled. Because I didn't know. I didn't know much about depth psych. I didn't know about anything.
Right, right.
Eventually, I realized depth psychology was a factor that I could eventually find something in. But even,
really?
Even with that, most
mm-hmm.
of the abnormality
mm-hmm.
Aspects of depth psychology, I didn't want to get into all of that.
Right.
I just wanted a particular answer. And so an awful lot of it I discovered on my own
mm-hmm.
in various ways.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, there had been this woman in a spiritualist church named Claire Olson, who it turns out had been in the OSS,
mm-hmm.
Had a big house. She had it was kind of like a fraternity house for working people.
Mm-hmm.
And so I stayed there, and she would let me run and
yeah.
talk. And there were many, many days where I was like talking 24 hours a day.
Yeah.
Of course, the poor woman was fascinated, but she must have been exhausted.
Yeah, it's
anyway,
like
she kept trying to get me to go to see Robert Carr at the Center of Integration.
Right.
Well, in the days before all this, like when I had been with somebody, I think at that party where I met Rita, who went over to this medium's place, and we went along, and there was these phony psychic trips, and at one point Robert Carr was a guest who had walked in,
mm-hmm.
who knew this guy, and he got up and started reading auras and,
mm-hmm.
and all the rest of it. So I thought, well,